take me to the mountains once again. Sailing where the wind is another highway. Seeing like an eagle where I used to be below. The roads I wandered long ago. I can see the mountain range begin. Shadows of the clouds across the highway. Promises a word they say for things they never do. Mountains are promises come true. Carry me on.
FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. Tonight's topic on Ecotopia is the national park system. We'll be talking with a former national park ranger, Andrea Lankford, who's written a book called Ranger Confidential, with some behind-the-scenes insights into the national park system, how it works, some of the problems it and its employees face. And with us in the studio tonight is Jeff Inslee, who will be helping us out with some of the announcements.
This program is made possible in part by member contributions and by Cartridge World and Chico, specializing in printer, cartridge refilling, and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-County's Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
And we'll be back with a brief history of our national park system and a discussion of some of its problems right after this.
Nature's weak, telling you something's wrong. It's nature's weak, telling you in a song. It's nature's way of saving you. It's nature's way of retrieving you. It's nature's way of telling you something's wrong. It's nature's way of telling you from the breeze. It's nature's way.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we'll be talking with former National Park Service Ranger Andrea Langford. We thought it would be helpful to background this discussion with a little history of national parks. This by Barry McIntosh, who was the Bureau historian for 17 years. He writes, "The national park concept is generally credited to the artist George Catlin, who did extensive painting of Western scenes, including American Indians. On a trip to the Dakotas in 1832, he worried about the impact of America's westward expansion on Indian civilization, wildlife, and wilderness. They might be preserved, he wrote, by some great protecting policy of the government in a magnificent park, a nation's park, containing man and beast in all the wild and freshness of nature's beauty." Catlin's vision was partly realized in 1864 when Congress donated Yosemite Valley to California for preservation as a state park. 8 years later, in 1872, Congress reserved the spectacular Yellowstone Country in the Wyoming-Montana territories as, quote, "a public park or pleasuring ground for the benefit and enjoyment of the people." With no state government there yet to receive and manage it, Yellowstone remained in the custody of the U.S. Department of the Interior as a national park, the world's first area so designated. Congress followed the Yellowstone precedent with other national parks in the 1890s and early 1900s, including Sequoia, Yosemite, Mount Rainier, Crater Lake, and Glacier. The idealistic impulse to preserve nature was often joined by the pragmatic desire to promote tourism. Western railroads lobbied for many of the early parks and built grand rustic hotels in them to boost their passenger business.
Barry McIntosh continues his history of the National Park Service by saying that in the late 19th century, we also saw growing interest in preserving prehistoric Indian ruins and artifacts on the public lands. Congress first moved to protect Arizona's Casa Grande ruin in 1889. In 1906, it created Mesa Verde National Park, containing dramatic cliff dwellings in southwestern Colorado, and passed the Antiquities Act, authorizing presidents to set aside, quote, historic and prehistoric structures and other objects of historic or scientific interest in federal custody as national monuments. Theodore Roosevelt used the act to proclaim 18 national monuments before he left the presidency. They included not only cultural features like El Morro, New Mexico, the site of prehistoric petroglyphs and historic inscriptions, but natural features like Arizona's Petrified Forest and Grand Canyon. Congress later converted many of these natural monuments to national parks.
By 1916, the Interior Department was responsible for 14 national parks and 21 national monuments, but had no organization to manage them. Interior secretaries had asked the Army to detail troops to Yellowstone and the California parks for this purpose. There, military engineers and cavalrymen developed park roads and buildings, enforced regulations against hunting, grazing, timber cutting, and vandalism, and did their best to serve the visiting public. The parks were vulnerable to competing interests, including some within the ascendant conservation movement. Utilitarian conservationists, favoring regulated use rather than strict preservation of natural resources, advocated the construction of dams by public authorities for water supply, power, and irrigation purposes. When San Francisco sought to dam Yosemite's Hetch Hetchy Valley for a reservoir after the turn of the century, the utilitarian and preservationist wings of the conservation movement came to blows. Over the passionate opposition of John Muir and other park supporters, Congress in 1913 permitted the dam, which historian John Ives later called the worst disaster ever to come to any national park.
In his history of the park system, Barry McIntosh goes on to cover a number of problems and ongoing concerns, the pressures between the conservationists and the utilitarians. His history also talks about such topics as overdevelopment of the parks for tourist purposes, exploitation and loss of natural resources, even as the parks have developed new attractions for tourists, including interpretive centers, exhibits focusing on environmentalism, living history projects, protection of nationally recognized historic places, and development and servicing of trails such as the Appalachian Trails.
We have posted the link to Barry McIntosh's full history on our website. He also has a strong bibliography, including links to an online history of the shaping of the national park system.
We'll be asking our guest, Andrea Lankford, about some of the problems that are facing the national park system, including some of these that are identified in an online article by Aisha Sebastian on the Yahoo Associated Content site. She writes, there are seven main areas of environmental problems that face the U.S. national park system: overuse, insufficient funds for park operation, threats to wildlife, the concession system, energy and mineral development, atmospheric pollution, and activities on adjacent lands. The popularity of national parks, especially the crown jewel parks like Yellowstone and Yosemite, have overwhelmed some national parks with visitors. In fact, the number of visitors to national parks has steadily increased by 10% each year. This massive increase in pedestrian and vehicle traffic has caused trails to become eroded from overuse, vegetation surrounding trails around popular attractions to be trampled by visitors, and litter, noise, water pollution, and smog to impede the enjoyability of national parks. This increase in visitors and the need for the few rangers employed by the park to meet the needs of more and more visitors have created a safety issue. Rangers can't monitor the entire park for criminal activity, and this impacts the safety of national parks. Wildlife at national parks is also threatened by the increasing popularity of these areas. More visitors mean there are more people approaching wild animals to take pictures and to watch their, quote, natural behaviors. While these observations don't necessarily harm the animals if done discreetly from a distance, there are a few irresponsible individuals who take risks to get close to animals. They harass the animals, provoke them in order to get an action shot or to prove their manhood.
Isla Sebastian continues, the concession system is another issue that is plaguing the national park system. In this case, private companies bid to sell their products in the park to visitors. While they are able to monopolize a market and they are allowed to operate on national park property, they only return 25% of the money earned to the government. This percentage doesn't make up for the amount of pollution they create from tourist littering or from environmental impacts of their concession stand and sales. There's more to read in this article about problems facing the national parks, and we've posted the link to Isla Sebastian's article at ecotopiakzfr.net.
We'll take a short break, and then we'll be back to ask former National Park Ranger Andrea Lankford about these and some other issues.
Sunshine on my shoulders makes me happy. In my eyes can make me cry. Sunshine on the water looks so lovely. Sunshine almost all makes me high. If I had a day that I could give you, I'd give to you a day just like today. A song that I could sing for you. I'd sing a song to make.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight our topic is the National Park System. On the phone with us tonight is Andrea Lankford. Andrea had a 12-year career as a ranger in the National Park System. She had assignments from Cape Hatteras to Utah to Yosemite and the Grand Canyon. She has also trekked the Appalachian Trail, its length, kayaked from Miami to Key West, cycled to the Arctic Ocean. Her book is called Ranger Confidential, and it has a foreboding subtitle, Living, Working, and Dying in the National Parks. Welcome, Andrea.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
Your book's a page-turner. We really enjoyed it. It's got a number of stories. They are often grim, sometimes kind of gallows humor, funny stories about rangers, and some that are just downright funny. You write about the range of humanity that shows up at our national parks. Before we hear some of those stories, I wonder if you could tell us a little more about yourself. How did you become a national park ranger wearing your Smokey Bear hat?
Well, I went to the University of Tennessee, and I got a degree in forestry there. And I wasn't having much luck getting a job when I graduated. I was bagging groceries for a living. But I had a boyfriend, and he invited me to come to go to a training with him, a six-week training program for people who wanted to be law enforcement rangers.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have anything better to do, so I went.
You could have majored in English. We trained English majors for years, and they couldn't get jobs either. We have to get more practical majors for folks.
Yeah.
So you didn't do it necessarily out of idealism, but as you got into the training program, why did you choose to become a ranger? And then as you got into it, did your expectations change?
Yeah, once my first job was at Cape Hatteras. I was 22, 23 years old when I started, and it did not take long before I was seduced by the mission. I kind of blame if you're going to blame something, it's the endangered baby sea turtles that I
mm-hmm.
helped protect
yeah.
while I worked there. And I was just so moved by their situation and that, for for me was a moment when I realized how high the stakes were, and I didn't care how much I got paid. I didn't care how horrible the housing was. I thought I had the most important job in the world.
And so how did that change over time?
It did change in a lot of ways. In my Ranger Confidential, I kind of show that progression through myself and three other park rangers and how our careers, some of it was just chronic, dealing with tragedies and getting mm-hmm. tired and working long hours. Some of it was becoming disillusioned with a bureaucracy and what comes
mm-hmm.
with that.
Right.
Also in frustration, dealing with the taxpayers who didn't really understand what the challenges that park rangers face.
You do say that the public has a variety of images of rangers, and not very many of those are accurate. What are the public's misperceptions?
Well, I like to say, you know, when we envision a park ranger, we have an image in our mind that's fit for a postcard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this stoic guy on horseback, or a, you know, all-American freckled-faced young woman walking through a cathedral of trees.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is it's a very challenging job, and a park ranger is dangerous. A park ranger is 12 times more likely to die on the job than is a special agent for the FBI.
Wow.
And every year, park rangers are the most assaulted federal officers of any, including DEA or Secret Service. But I do have to say, this year, the Forest Service officials topped the park rangers.
Okay.
Can we talk a little bit more? Why does that? You talk about one of the public images that comes to be a view of cops restricting everybody's good times. You talk about going into taverns out in the town, and people sneer at the rangers just because you represent the law.
Yeah, you know, when you're working for the federal government, you have to enforce some unpopular rules and regulations. You know, nobody likes to get arrested, you know, whether it's for drugs or assault, or they drove a vehicle in a place closed because of tern nesting. So there's always a bit of violence that comes with having to do that line of work.
And you talk as well about the fact that people expect the rangers to kind of bow and scrape. That is, you're like weight people as well as being law authorities.
Yeah, I think when people come into a park, they don't expect a ranger to approach them with carrying a pistol, for example. They're on vacation. They want to have fun. Some people are under the influence of alcohol. All these things come into play that, you know, they think, who's this kid ranger telling me what to do?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it often does. Once at Zion National Park, we had neo-Nazis that wanted to take over the park for a whites-only homeland.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. What happened at that point?
Well, they ended up being a little bit more bark than they were bite, and mm-hmm. at times it was bizarrely, absurdly humorous. You know, they were out there in the paper, Zieg Highland, to this formation called the Great White Throne.
Oh my gosh!
but you know, it's a threat. It can. They said they were going to shoot any ranger that didn't throw down their badge.
Yeah, yeah.
So the credo is protect the park from the people from the park, and the people from themselves. Have you experienced all of those?
Yes.
That's the
several times a day in one day.
Right.
I just want to mention, that's the unofficial credo. That's not a National Park Service
yes,
credo.
Yes, you're right. That is the unofficial credo, but you ask any park ranger and they will spout that out.
They can recite it
immediately. Yes.
Well, maybe you could tell us a couple stories. Could you tell what dumb things that tourists do is one of the categories I jotted down, although these dumb things can often be tragic. But do you have a story or two for us about what tourists have done?
Yeah, people, they're really out of their elements oftentimes. You know, at Zion, I had people point up to a porcupine in a tree and say, look, it's a monkey. we had nudist hikers running down the trails in Yosemite and park rangers having to chase them. People in Yosemite, they like to ask, what time of the year do you turn off the waterfalls?
No kidding. Wow.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, and at Grand Canyon, they like to ask, is the mule train air-conditioned, and where's the elevator down to the
no.
bottom?
Really?
Yeah, really.
And they also, you say, particularly at the Grand Canyon, they look down and say, that isn't so deep. I think I could do that as a day hike. And
defy it.
Yes, in the Grand Canyon, it has sucked in, you know, the strongest of men. Even the first Europeans to visit the park, the Native Americans warned them, don't go down there, it's harder than you think. They're like, ah, you're wimps, we can make it, you can see the water. You know, they couldn't get down there. So, you know, all from that time, even today, everybody, oh, it's downhill all the way. It's going to be so easy. I'm going to go down in flip-flops, carrying a can of Coke.
Oh, gosh.
And unfortunately, you know, sometimes it's funny, but sometimes those people end up getting in big trouble, and some even have died on the trail.
Could you tell us a little bit about scorpions and ranger karma down there at Phantom Ranch in Grand Canyon?
Yeah, at Grand Canyon, I was the district ranger over the Cross Canyon Corridor, and there down at the bottom, there's a place called Phantom Ranch, and there's a ranger assigned that lives down there, and there's a scorpion down there called the bark scorpion. It's the only deadly poisonous scorpion in the United States. You're not likely to die from it unless you're extremely young or old or allergic, but it hurts like a you-know-what.
Yeah.
So you really, the rangers will take extraordinary measures to avoid being stung. Some of them put, you know, their bedposts all in glass jars so they wouldn't crawl up in the bed.
Right.
What happened is we got this superstition that if you killed a scorpion, you were bound to be stung by one. And we called that scorpion karma. So in Ranger Confidential, I tell a story about a volunteer named Shores Horseman, and he actually, you know, when he found a scorpion in the ranger station, you scoop it up with a piece of paper and let it go. He would feed it flies. He kept a jar of flies on his windowsill and feed the scorpion flies just to, you know, a little extra insurance that he wouldn't get stung.
One of the wonderful stories in your book, it extends throughout the book, the story of Mary the typist, who turns out to be the Thanksgiving Ledge rescuer toward the end of the book. I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit of her story, how she started out and where she wound up.
Well, when I came to Yosemite Valley, it had a reputation of being hard on female rangers. The assistant superintendent told me I was a test case to prove that women could handle work in Yosemite Valley. One of my co-workers was Mary Littell, and she was a rock climber and gung-ho, athletic, competitive, and she and I, we just weren't going to let that fly. But it was hard to get on the more glamorous missions, but, you know, in the end, she did get to be the first woman to go over the edge of El Capitan, which is 3,000 feet high, attached to nothing but a rope about, you know, the size of your thumb, wick the thickness. And it's real dramatic. And it just kind of gets more absurd as she goes down the rope, and the climbers that she's, I mean, they're going to die if the rangers don't save them.
Right.
But when she swings over and they see that the person rescuing them is actually a woman, one of them says, oh, no, it's a chick. But she ends up being the hero and helps get those guys up. And right now she is the chief ranger at Lake Mead in Nevada. Yeah.
So and she had to do time as a typist to work her way into the service.
Yeah, back then it was really hard to get a full-time permanent job with benefits with the National Park Service. And she had to get a job as a clerk typist, had to take a test, you know, had to work at a desk. It was just what a ranger hates.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually when she did this rescue, in time, she got a full-time permanent job with the agency.
Right. So you write that there's a good deal of discrimination against women in the Park Service. Can you describe, I mean, this is sort of an example of that, but are there other experiences that you've had with discrimination, and how did that affect you?
Well, you know, historically, there's always been, you know, a little bit of an issue. There were times where they wouldn't call the women park rangers. They made them wear different uniforms. You know, I came in the late 80s and 90s. It wasn't quite that bad. But today, you know, there's been a female Secretary of Interior, a female Director of the National Park Service. A lot of women that I worked with are now in high-level positions in Washington, D.C. So it's improved a lot. Another thing I like to say, even though a lot of the rangers were sexist, the male rangers, they were also sexy, and I ended up marrying one of them. And today is actually our 10-year anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
All right.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, after 12 years, you left the Park Service. You've hinted at why that might have been, but could you tell us the story of what led you finally to leave the service?
After 4 years, you know, 2 years at Yosemite and 4 years at Grand Canyon, I just felt beat up by the Grand Canyon. One thing rangers say is the Grand Canyon is a park that chews up park rangers and spits them out. I was there during the most deadliest hiking season in the history of the park in 1996, and just the disillusionment and the work hours. God, I had seen several friends and coworkers that have died on the job. I just got burned out, mm-hmm. and I quit and moved on and did some of these, you know, the hiking and the biking and the stuff that you mm-hmm. talked about earlier.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what makes the Grand Canyon such a challenging job? Is it the dangers of the hikers or the risks that people take there? And then what that asks of rangers or something else?
Yeah, it's an extreme environment, and it's one of the busiest backcountry areas in the nation, if not the world, for search and rescue. Mm-hmm. You fly into remote, dangerous situations. You got river rapids you may have to pluck people out of. You have forest fires. And then you also have a village in the park that's right. like a town.
Right.
So the rangers also responding to law enforcement things that you might see in any town.
Oh, okay.
Law enforcement
mm-hmm.
problems. So you add all that with staffing that's not adequate.
Right.
And, you know, it's a perfect storm.
Right, right.
We're going to take a short break and ask you to talk a little more after the break about some more about those problems and what might be done to remedy them. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Andrea Lankford. She's the author of Ranger Confidential, Living, Working, and Dying in the National Parks. It's published by Falcon Guides, part of the Globe Pequot Press. And we'll be right back after this.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we are on the phone with Andrea Lankford, whose book, Ranger Confidential, talks about her experience. She talks about her experiences, actually, in the national park system. And before we go on to talk about, you know, how rangers' lives could be made better and how we could improve the park system. I'm just curious about what your best, we kind of talked about some negative things. What were the best experiences you had, or what stands out as something you really loved about doing this work?
Well, the sea turtles always come to mind, right, immediately. Mm-hmm. Helping the nest and protecting them from off-road vehicles, and watching the baby sea turtles do their, you know, crawl to the ocean.
Right.
Still, you know, it still shows. Yeah, just
yeah, it's really neat. Yeah.
But also working with I worked with incredible people, and some of them I still love dearly. And we were in intense circumstances and often saved people's lives.
Right.
I also played a part in a innovative preventative search and rescue program at the Grand Canyon, which is still ongoing today and appears to be saving lives every year.
Nice. That's really great. So the U.S. park system is unique in the world. In what ways do you see it as fulfilling the dreams of park advocates like John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt? And in what ways do you think it's falling short?
Well, I think John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt should be really proud, because in 2009, there was 285 million visits to 350-plus national park areas that are being protected. That's a lot of people enjoying our national parks, which for the most part are left impaired, you know, for future generations, and that is the agency's primary mission. So you know, for the most part, we should all be proud of our national parks still. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of great stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're failing, you know, one is very challenging. It's the dilution of the agency by pork barrel parks.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'd be really curious to know what John Muir would think of that.
What do you mean by pork barrel parks?
Congressman, you know, favoring a park that really probably should be a state park or a community park, or maybe in private hands, and because they get on these, you know, it gets attached to these bills, it gets funded, and the system has become diluted. Therefore, your big crown jewel parks like Yosemite, Everglades, Great Smokies may not be getting the funding and staffing that they deserve.
Right, right.
But you also write in the book about some frivolous projects as well, like a train at Grand Canyon that goes nowhere, and a winery in another national park.
Yeah, Cuyahoga Valley. There was, I believe, about $2 million overall has been given to support a winery in Cuyahoga Valley. The Grand Canyon, they've gone through several failed projects, you know, trying to fix a wheel that perhaps is not broken, and wasting millions of dollars in the process. Mm-hmm. It's the trainless train station. There was a train station built on a bus station that was going to be a centralized location. Well, the buses couldn't make the turn front of the station with the design of it. So it was all a fail, you know. It was offices last time I was there. I don't know what they're doing with it now.
Oh, my gosh.
So there is a lot of waste and planning that goes wrong, like we've seen with some other federal agencies. But yeah, there's some people have called it the National Pork Service.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But that doesn't trickle down very often to the rangers. You write at some length about both pay and living conditions. Could you talk a little bit about that and what might be done? Would that help attract more people into the ranger service if those conditions were better?
Yes. I think there will always be idealistic people attracted to work for the Park Service, mm-hmm. but the agency should also work on retaining talent and not losing people through accidents or, you know, burnout.
So
the staffing level needs to be good, and the pay level needs to be relative to what they would get either in the private sector or with another federal agency.
Mm-hmm.
My advice would be that park rangers who do law enforcement, their pay scale needs to be more in line with what federal special agents get paid.
Right. I had no idea that in the Grand Canyon it was the park rangers that had to deal with the village and all of the behaviors that can go wrong when people are just, you know, hanging out.
Right. you know, you've got residents, year-round residents, and you got people on vacation. I tell one story in Ranger Confidential is about a homicidal fugitive that basically holds the entire park hostage for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
Shot at one of the park rangers in the book.
Wow.
And you spent much of that time then trying to track him down. He was kind of elusive during that 2 weeks?
Yeah, Danny Ray Horning was his name. He's on death row in California right now. He took several people hostages. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he would keep them for a while, and then he would try to take some and would fail. He ended up escaping the park after 2 weeks and was caught down near Sedona, Arizona.
So did you ever have to use your gun you must have had to draw your gun.
Yeah, I did. I did come across people. Fortunately, thank goodness, I never had to shoot a person.
Yeah.
I sometimes had to use it with wildlife.
Okay.
And sometimes had to use it to gain compliance from lawbreakers in the national park.
Okay, mm-hmm. Right.
We read a piece earlier that alluded briefly to the concession system, and I know you've got some criticisms of that also. I wonder if you could talk about how that works and whether that could be adjusted, say, to channel monies into places where they're needed.
We certainly need concessions in maybe not all, but a lot of national parks, especially the more remote and isolated. We need places for people to eat,
right,
and stay the night and go to the bathroom and this type of thing. So the concession does a valuable service to the park visitor. What happens is, in the past, they've paid their employees so low that they're attracting undesirable elements. They're packing them in housing situations that made some of them victims while the others were predators. And, of course, the park rangers have to deal with this situation.
Mm-hmm.
I did recently go to Yosemite and see some improvements. They had built a dorm for the employees there, and I was very pleased to see that the employees were living in this dorm instead of in the tent cabins at a place called Boys Town.
Mm-hmm.
So the Park Service role, to me, should be a watchdog for the concessions. You know, these big corporations are making millions of dollars profit. They need to invest back into their employees.
Right. I wanted to mention that.
Happy and healthy and, well took care of.
I remember the last time I was in Yellowstone, the concessions looked like your down-home country store, except for silkscreen T-shirts and the usual tourist paraphernalia. But they are anything but a down-home country store. As you say, they're pulling in millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, the permit holders are often huge corporations. For a while, one of them was owned by Japan.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how big some of these things are.
Yeah. And it seems like there should be more emphasis on environmentally sensitive products, organic food and recyclable utensils or compostable or whatever. And I think in some places, just trash. I mean, it's trash food and trash stuff. I went to John Muir, however, recently, or Muir Woods, and fabulous concessions, very environmentally conscious and food conscious, health conscious.
Yeah, I think we're starting to see some improvement. I'd mentioned something about doughy white food.
Yes,
still been
exactly.
To the parks where that's uh-huh. all you can order.
Right.
But I also have seen some great improvements in that area. And some superintendents, are doing a wonderful job at doing some progressive things in a few of the parks. It's real hit or miss.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We saw that the first family vacationed in Acadia over the weekend. What's your sense in the current hard economic times? How is the Park Service faring, and does it have a friend in the current president?
Well, with the recession, it kind of changed the dynamic for the Park Service. One thing, the federal government relatively now is a good place to try to get a job. More so than it was 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got more quality people applying for the jobs. Also, the stimulus package.
Yes.
Their Park Service, I'm trying to remember the exact figure, it's $750 million has been granted to the Park Service for 800 projects. I glanced at those projects, and no pork, screamed back at me.
Mm-hmm.
It was
okay.
Good,
yeah.
Sturdy
yeah.
stuff that they were going to accomplish with this. And a lot of that comes from Obama's stimulus package. Mm-hmm. So, you know, looking at that, I have to call him a friend of the national parks.
And in addition to the hard times, how else do you think the Park Service is faring, for example, with Congress, with conservatives? Where does that money come from? And do you have a sense there of how Congress is feeling toward the Park Service at the moment?
You know, I don't know if I have a good sense of that. I mean, one thing I do like to say about that, though, when we were in the Park Service, we were sort of raised to see Congress as the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And that all our problems were because Congress, you know, would make mistakes and wouldn't give mm-hmm. us funding that we needed. Mm-hmm. It was mm-hmm. sort of like this mythology that was passed down to
mm-hmm.
us.
Sure.
I did have a time to help tour around the Interior Appropriations Committee at the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the congressman taking notes, paying attention.
Nice.
It changed my attitude.
Nice.
And now I don't like to see superintendents trying to throw the blame at Congress or the director, you know, and hope that it
mm-hmm.
sticks.
Mm-hmm.
They also need to take responsibility. You know, Congress, political driven, they're going to do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some
mm-hmm.
of that's never going to go away.
Right.
So the directors and the superintendents, they need to take charge and do the best they can with the tools that they are given.
Right, right. So if you were the director of the National Park System, what are the first things you would do?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, one thing, I would want to keep the agency focused on its core mission. I get a little anxious when I see some of these grand initiatives that are going international or these outreaches that are going too far. I had one, a chief ranger, tell me about how the Park Service should help, you know, that children aren't getting obese. That's not part of the Park Service's
mm-hmm.
mission.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right, right.
And when their own house is nice and clean, yeah, maybe they can step out and start cleaning other people's houses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but right now, I would want them to continue to stay focused on their core mission. And it's great to do outreach to get children excited about the outdoors, but it should be, you know, within the park mostly, or, mm-hmm. you know, more focused within the park.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you've done since you left the Park Service? How do you spend, other than hiking, biking, kayaking, and doing other wild adventures, how do you spend your time?
Well, I also, amongst all writing 4 books and doing all that traveling, I went back to school, and I'm now a registered nurse.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm.
So I also work as a private duty nurse.
Oh,
excellent.
Fabulous.
And so between all that stuff, it keeps me busy.
Yeah.
Indeed. We want to thank you, Andrea Langford, for being with us tonight. The book is Ranger Confidential, Living, Working, and Dying in the National Parks. It's a Falcon Guide publication of Globe Pequot Press. Andrea had referred to her other books. These include Bicycling the Arizona Trail, Biking the Grand Canyon Area, and one called Haunted Hikes, Spine-Tingling Tales and Trails from America's National Park. You can learn more about those books and about Andrea at her website. It's www.andrealankford.com. And thank you very much, Andrea, for being with us. We really enjoyed talking with you tonight.
Thank you, guys. I enjoyed it.
Good luck with your projects.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Donate your used vehicle to support community radio. The donation is tax deductible and the towing is free. Call 1-888-KZFR-AUTO. That's 1-888-593-7288.
That was Haunted by the Waters from the film A River Runs Through It. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we've been talking about the National Park System. On the cover of her book, Ranger Confidential, Andrea Lankford's book shows a battered ranger hat, commonly called a smoky bear hat, flat brim, familiar to us all through the forest fire prevention ads.
Smokey Bear is actually not a member of the National Park Service. He represents the National Forest Service, a separate government division that is actually part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Nevertheless, we thought it might be interesting to close out tonight's program with a brief history of Smokey Bear.
And remember, listeners, the proper name is Smokey Bear, not Smokey the Bear, even though when I was a child, we sang a song that we learned called Smokey the Bear from their ads. So many people say Smokey the Bear because we learned that when we were kids. But here's a history from the Pennsylvania Forestry Division. Smokey Bear, the guardian of the forest, has been a part of the American scene for so many years, it's hard for us to remember when he first appeared. Dressed in a ranger's hat, belted blue jeans, and carrying a shovel, he has been the recognized forest fire prevention symbol for over 50 years. Today, Smokey Bear is one of the most famous advertising symbols in the world and is protected by federal law. He has his own private zip code, his own legal counsel, and his own private committee to ensure that his name is used properly. Smokey Bear is much more than a make-believe paper image. He exists as an actual symbol of forest fire prevention.
To understand how Smokey Bear became associated with forest fire prevention, we must go back to World War II. On December 7, 1941, Japanese planes attacked Pearl Harbor. The following spring, in 1942, a Japanese submarine surfaced near the coast of Southern California and fired a salvo of shells that exploded on an oil field near Santa Barbara, very close to the Los Padres National Forest. Americans throughout the country were shocked by the news that the war had now been brought directly to the American mainland. There was concern that further attacks could bring a disastrous loss of life and destruction of property. There's also a fear that enemy incendiary shells exploding in the timber stands of the Pacific coast could easily set off numerous raging forest fires. With experienced firefighters and other able-bodied people engaged in the armed forces, the home communities had to deal with forest fires as best they could. Protection of these forests became a matter of national importance, and a new idea was born. If people could be urged to be more careful, perhaps some of the fires could be prevented.
The history from the Pennsylvania Forestry Division tells us that with this in mind, the Forest Service organized the Cooperative Forest Fire Prevention Campaign with the help of the Wartime Advertising Council. Posters and slogans were created by the Advertising Council, including "Forest fires aid the enemy," and "Our carelessness, their secret weapon." By using these catchy phrases, colorful posters, and other fire prevention messages, the Advertising Council suggested that people could prevent accidental fires and help win the war.
Walt Disney's Bambi was produced in 1944, and Disney let the Forest Fire Prevention Campaign use his creation on a poster. The Bambi poster was a success and proved that using an animal as a fire prevention symbol could work. A fawn could not be used in the subsequent campaigns because Bambi was on loan from Walt Disney Studios for only 1 year. The Forest Service would need to find an animal that would belong to the Cooperative Forest Fire Prevention Campaign. It was finally decided that the nation's number one firefighter should be a bear.
On August 9, 1944, the first poster of Smokey Bear was prepared. The poster depicted a bear pouring a bucket of water on a campfire. Smokey Bear soon became popular, and his image began appearing on other posters and cards.
In 1952, Smokey Bear had enough public recognition to attract commercial interest. An act of Congress passed to take Smokey out of the public domain and place him under the control of the Secretary of Agriculture. The act provided for the use of collected fees and royalties for forest fire prevention. One of the first licensed items was a Smokey Bear stuffed toy. Hundreds of items have been licensed over the years.
We've posted the link to that history of Smokey Bear on our website, and it's www.dcnr.state.pa.us/forestry. And we posted the link to the Smokey Bear official website, which is www.smokeybear.com. That's it for Ecotopia this evening.
Ecotopia is made possible by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer, cartridge refilling, and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to the Tri-Counties Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333.
Coming up this evening at 7 is the storyteller with your anthropological guide, Adrian Scott, bringing you stories, legends, and music from long ago and modern-day cultures. Join Adrian for a trip around the world, exploring the hopes, fears, and dreams that are universal to all people. And at 7:30, it's All Mixed Up, bringing you 2.5 hours of rock and pop from the edges of mainstream and contemporary music, blurring the boundaries of most commercial radio. Stay tuned and enjoy listening to a world that's all mixed up. Thanks for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com or visit our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. You can also become our friends on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows.
The proud and the mighty all have stumbled. Shine on me again now. Tree of loving.